My name's Mandy, and I'm the RNLI Water Safety Officer at Wells Lifeboat Station. I'm also crew on both of the boats that we have there. We've been creating a series of podcasts to share water safety information with visitors and locals, wrapped in what is hopefully some interesting local knowledge. The idea is that the better educated everyone is, the less likely you are to get into difficulties in or by the water, and therefore the safer we all are. These podcasts cover tides, kayaking, how to behave around seals, and lots of other interesting subjects. Today's podcast is slightly different to the others. I normally record an informal interview with a local expert on a specific subject. However, in the summer, I was lucky enough to have a guided tour of Scaldhead Island Nature Reserve with Neil and Gavin, two of the Natural England wardens, responsible for protecting and encouraging the native wildlife to thrive there. What you're about to hear is a recording of Neil and Gavin having a general group discussion about Scaldhead Island and their work, and I'll be interspersing this with some relevant water safety messages. Fingers crossed all this works.
Okay, Sandwich Tank is the biggest site.
They're only at Blakeney?
No, they're all here. There's very little at Blakeney.
We're trying to
work on that. So 3,300 pairs of sandwich terns, and they look set to fledge, or probably have now fledged, about a chick per pair, which is as good as we can ever expect.
Excellent.
So the last 2 years, they've been hit really hard by avian influenza. And we fledged just low hundreds, 200, 400 birds, pretty much like all the chicks, 90% of the chicks died, and significant proportion of adults, so they were hit really hard. Black-headed gulls, about 2,000 pairs, again, they were hit really hard by avian influenza. The last 2 years, they fledged virtually no young, but this year they're going to fledge probably two chicks per pair, about 4,000 young, so it's really, really good. Little terns, we've got about 150 pairs, which is going to be about the second, third biggest colony in the UK this year, but I'd be surprised if we fledged any young. They've been hit really hard by predation. So we've had marsh harrier, red kite, and the last 2 weeks, shorting owl, which is a bit of a novel thing. It's a thing that doesn't happen every year, only very occasionally, but we've got a shorted owl that's living here and it just lives in the little tern colony at night time.
And there's just one?
Just one, yeah, I think so. Wouldn't rule it out that there's perhaps not a breeding pair, but they're a rare breeding bird in Norfolk, but occasionally they do. But that seems to have been an issue all the way along the coast this year with shorted owls. Probably something to do with the late spring, cold spring, and birds just not going anywhere. Ring plovers, we've got about 60 to 65 pairs. And that's probably the best site in England for ring plovers. It's a bird that's in massive decline. It's declined by 50% since about the early 1990s. And that's down to they like to nest on beaches where people like to sit and have a picnic. So they do reasonably well on Scalt. We have good numbers on Scalt, mainly because of our lack of visitors. So they're all concentrated down at the East End. But for 95% of the rest of the island, it's tiny. They've struggled this year. That's partly due to the weather, but partly due to, again, a lot of predation. It's just one of those years. Some years things do really well. Like last year, everything did really well. We fledged loads of oyster catchers, loads of ring plovers. This year, we're going to really struggle. Weather, predation, some nests have lost to high tides and things like that. So.
Were the waders hit by bird flu last year?
So the things that were hit worst by bird flu were black-headed gulls and sandwich terns. So sandwich terns, you can get up to 10 nests in a square metre. So
it spreads.
Yeah, so it's exactly, yeah. And they defecate just in the nest. So they're spraying each other in bird poo and it spreads like that. So then the chicks become mobile, and literally within a day of catching it, we were having chicks die. We took off 200 kilos of dead sandwich tern chicks in one day last year. By the time we got back, we looked at the camera, and there was already new dead ones in there.
Oh.
But this year, so Nationally, sandwich turn population, RSPBSN declined by 40%, and the estimate is if with no further outbreaks of bird flu, that will take probably 2 decades to get back to.
Well,
so what we do is we do our management and sandwich, we farm sandwich turns of black-headed gulls, essentially. So we put electric fences up, and we control predators. So we spend quite a lot of money, time and resources on shooting foxes. If we didn't, we wouldn't have any sandwich turns. So these electric fences are just a secondary line of defence on days like this when our predator control guy can't get out and shoot foxes. So
the foxes cross over the...
They just walk across low tide. Yeah, they just, you know...
They can do it?
Yeah, they can do it, yeah. And I've seen them swim out, like... Small high tides.
They're not getting cut off by the tide then.
Yeah. But mostly they walk out at low tide.
They can't use their paws to ring
iron. Oh, is that the problem? Right, they can't ring 999.
Yeah. Where?
Just gone over the top.
Oh.
Bouncing away.
Are they breeding here?
Yeah, there's loads. Yeah, they've exploded in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yes.
And with them, they've bought ticks.
Yes.
Which never used to be here.
No, I saw in the risk assessment there's a bit on ticks.
But they're more of an issue further down the island. But I mean, I don't think there's anywhere in Norfolk now that's not got a tick problem. So.
Yeah. And I was wondering, are there hedgehogs?
No hedgehogs. No. So.
Well, that's a relief.
One thing we don't have to worry about.
Yeah.
Stoats, weasels, rats, but no hedgehogs, no badgers. Cajun otter, not that I've ever seen one out here, but I've seen the prints.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So the storks and weasels coming across and then just staying here?
Yeah, yes, again, they'll swim across, yeah.
And what we've had, I'd never even thought about it.
Well, the amazing one is that until 3 years ago, I'd only ever seen like 2 hares out here.
Oh, I saw one while we were in the house.
Yeah, and now hares are colonised. Hares have swam across, I saw one swim across the harbour. At high tide.
Really?
And hare numbers now are going up, and they're replacing rabbits and replaced the rabbits. But I would hardly ever saw a hare.
Yeah, it's nice they're here and they're not getting hit by other cars on the mainland. Yeah. I like hares a lot.
It's just the idea of them swimming across that's quite interesting.
It's bizarre when you think of any of these animals that you usually associate with like land-based.
Yeah.
Foxes, deer, red deer.
Yeah.
Hares, or just.
I think it would probably be too much for a hedgehog to swim across. You never know.
They've only got a little leg.
So you'll have heard us joking about foxes and other animals crossing over the Skoltar Island, either by fording over at low tide or swimming across at high tide. Very like us humans. As you heard Neil say, people being on the island does disturb the wildlife. From a water safety perspective, you're also running a serious risk of being cut off by the tide. The currents around Skoltar Island are very strong when the tide is coming in and going out. Crossing from the east, Gun Hill or Holcombe Beach side onto Skoltar Island, or from the west, i.e. Brancaster Beach, at any other time other than low water will result in you either being swept into the harbour if the tide is coming in, or worse, out to sea if the tide is going out. We have rescued people that have tried to wade across these channels and have been swept out to sea. This is a very dangerous situation to be in. Please avoid these times of the tide. If you are walking out to Skoltar Island and intend to walk back, make sure that you are back on dry sand stroke land with no more creeks or channels to cross at least 4 hours before Wells Bar high tide time. If you do find yourself cut off by the tide, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard whilst trying to stay calm and dry. The app or three words can be useful as it gives a very precise location, which means we can get help to you more quickly. Back to the wildlife discussion. Just to help you orientate yourself, when Neil talks about this end of Skoltar Island, he's talking about the west side of Skoltar Island, which is the end nearest Brancaster Beach.
So I think Gavin said, yes, this end's out of bounds. There's no dogs anywhere on the island between mid-April and mid-August, which includes the extreme east end. I have never seen so many people. I think we had 30 days of calling the lifeboat out. And certainly, less so at this end, but at the east end, there's definitely been more people. And more people with 200. More dogs.
Nobody people have discovered Scald Head, haven't they, really? Unfortunately, it's been in the press and all sorts.
Which we can't control. There's barely a weekend when it's not in one of the top 10 secret beaches or secret islands.
We try to respond, you know, saying the further you've got to walk out to the beach, the less time you've actually got there before you get into trouble.
I mean, even at the East End, what we do find is that most people will just land the boat and won't walk more than 100 metres.
By honeypot in that respect. People don't travel.
I suppose that's good, isn't it? If you've just got it all in just one small place.
It is. But unfortunately, that bit is the bit that's quite good for birds.
That's unfortunate then.
We do sacrifice some habitat for ring plovers and oyster catchers.
That bit there where they land is actually quite good. There's two pairs of oyster catchers that nest there, and there's another pair of oyster catchers that nest there. And the rest of the beach, it's not a huge amount, the rest of the beach, because the storms cut along the cliff, and it caused a lot of sand to fall.
Yeah.
It's not as ideal, but still gets it.
I know that oyster catchers can live for 40 years or so.
Yep.
So do they come back to the same nest
site? Yeah,
I see, right.
Literally the same nest site. Yeah. There's a pair nest here, and periodically they get flooded, so I built them a little mound, and they still use the same mound every year. They're incredibly long-lived.
I didn't realise they lived as long as that.
Hill, there's a hollow, there's a dune hollow, and there's an oyster catcher that nests. Yeah, you can pretty much pinpoint where they're going to go. There's always a double nest there. There's two females that lay their eggs in the same nest, and they do it all the time. And the hollow one always gets moved on. They don't. But sandwich terns are also long lived.
Yeah, 19, 20 years.
So that's another thing that with the populations getting hit by avian influenza, we won't fully see some of the effects until a few years down the road.
So the next 2 years, we'll see further sandwich tern declines, whether there's avian influenza or not, because they don't breed until they're 3 years old.
Right.
So we've got 2 years of pretty much no recruitment anywhere in northwestern Europe. So we'll see whatever the adult mortality is, 7%, 6%, so we'll see, you know.
When you say no recruitment, what does that mean?
No fledged chicks.
Right.
So we're not adding to the population.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so we just didn't, you know, 2 years of not fledging any chicks anywhere in Europe, more or less. Yeah.
I think the biggest concern of all was great skuas, wasn't it? Sandwich terns maybe not far behind.
I think great skuas in the north were the worst hit, and probably, the sandwich terns the next one down the line.
I've seen a skua around here.
There's lots of skuas here at the moment. I've seen four today.
Well.
Yeah. So they'll be birds that are now heading back south. And they'll hang around off here for a few weeks chasing the terns. Mm. And they're birds that are probably bred in Scotland or Scandinavia, somewhere like that. So numbers of those will pick up over the next few weeks.
If an oyster catcher's chick is born here, do they come back here or do they go off somewhere completely different?
Yeah.
Do you get little family colonies, family groups? Or?
No, they'll be separate, but the birds that are breeding here are probably related to birds that bred here 20 years ago.
Right.
But because they're long-lived, They're fledging really small numbers of young oyster catchers at the moment. And they're declining all the while on the coast. But because they're living for 20, 30 years, that decline is really gradual.
Yeah.
So we're losing like two or three pairs every year. So when I first started here, we had about 108 pairs, 110 pairs. We've got about 82 pairs now.
I suppose it lures you into a false sense of security if it's slow, isn't it?
Mirrored exactly on Blakeney Point. They had similar numbers. They're down to 80 pairs. Oyster catchers just seem to be fairly useless as well. They'll fledge chicks, and often I'll find the chicks dead. They're just... Mm.
Oyster catchers that nest over on the main beach, aren't they? Where there's often a rope around.
That's it. Yeah, so there's about 10 pairs of oyster catchers over there, and there's about half a dozen pairs of ring plovers. And they surprisingly do quite well. But there's a relationship between disturbance from people, but that disturbs predators, so there's less predation, so it's quite interesting.
In a gull colony, so sandwich terns won't nest without black-headed gulls. because sandwich terns are hopeless at seeing off predators. Oh. So they rely on black-headed gulls to do that function. So
also sort of cooperating.
Yeah, yeah. So this, you know, your odds, if you've got 6,000 chicks here, your odds of your chick getting predated by a marsh harrier are pretty slim. So, you know, not, that's what the black-headed gulls function. So, this is, you know, interesting and gruesome, but it's not an issue. There's more of an issue with a shorted owl or the red kites living in the little tern colony.
I suppose once they realise there's a rich source of food there, there's got no reason to go anywhere else, have they?
Yeah.
There's so much history to little terns. 50 years ago, there was a lot of concern. I think the number, is it around 1600, 1800? It's been fairly steady. Yeah. But
so what the big change in little terns in recent years is the number of sites that they nest in Norfolk has more than halved.
Right.
So they would have been at, say, 15 sites, and they're probably now at only 6 sites.
Yeah.
And that's partly because the places they want to be, again, are beaches. So, you know, just lots of different places. They've gone from Titchell, they've gone from Brancaster, they've gone from Holm. So they're just being concentrated into fewer and fewer sites in bigger numbers. So if they fail at that site,
they've got a predator or something.
And traditionally, because they like quite temporary habitats, so they like the bearer shingle spits. So they would have traditionally just moved from a site's created, moved on to another site, and that's happening less and less because, those sites are just full of people. The coast is just getting busier and busier and busier, you've probably all seen. I mean, when I moved up here, you would never see anybody in the winter or until June, July. European sandwich terns, all the colonies, this massive interchange between sites. So birds will breed here 1 year. Next year, they could be in Holland, Denmark, Germany, and vice versa. So the cameras have let me read rings. So we have birds breeding here that fledged in every European sandwich tern colony, from Ireland, Wales, Scotland. So this just a massive interchange. So you have to look at the whole managing sandwich tern colonies as all the sites and not just the insular and just look at Skull.
So they just build a nest where they're feeding at the time, kind of thing, do they?
Yeah, so there's traditional sites. So the two traditional sites in Norfolk are here and Blakeney. But they will follow the large black-headed gull colonies. So if we lost all our black-headed gulls next year and we didn't have any, we'd struggle to get any sandwich terns.
And what's the relationship there? You say that sandwich terns and little terns have a relationship.
Sandwich terns and black-headed gulls.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so black-headed gulls are the first ones. They settle earlier, so they draw on the sandwich terns. Sandwich terns are hopeless at looking, seeing off predators. They will sit and watch their eggs and chicks get eaten. Mm-hmm. Black-headed gulls will mob them and try and drive things off, so there's a benefit there. There's a benefit in security in numbers. And then there's a little bit of payback for the black-headed gulls. They will rob the sandwich terns as they come in with food for their chicks. So these sandwich terns are fishing offshore up to 60, 70 kilometres for one fish. They will go around to Yarmouth, they'll go as far as Yorkshire for a fish and fly back with one sand eel. But sand eel can be 18 inches long. And, you know, the chicks are often that small that they'll swallow a sand eel. They'll wait for the first half to digest before they swallow the rest of it.
Well, then they're sitting ducks for anything that wants to have the rest of the sand eel.
Yeah.
Do the black-headed gulls ever go after tern chicks?
Occasionally.
A few years ago at Mincemeat, they were hammering the Avocet chick.
So there was a little bit of issue with that. These things can be buggers. Mediterranean gulls, they're very aggressive, and in some years, they will target sandwich tern chicks, little tern chicks.
Yeah.
But not every year.
Right.
And we think there's probably a relationship between pig farms, pig fields, because they'll go off inland and feed on pig fields.
Interesting.
And if they're not around locally, they have to go too far, they'll target sandwich tern chicks and eggs.
It might just be worth saying, I forget, 20, 25 years ago, Mediterranean gulls were really rare. Whether it's climate change.
These birds here, over the last 3 or 4 weeks, there's been birds from Dutch colonies, colonies in Poland, bizarrely Hungary. There's several birds that are ringed in Hungary that are breeding here now. And that's where they've come from. They've moved across. And, yeah, when I first started here in 97, I think we had one pair, and we've got 70 pairs this year.
Amazing.
Yeah.
There was a big influx from Titchwell in my first year.
Yeah.
So they got those water levels screwy.
Again, to look, we can't look at Skull, what Titchwell does or what Snetsham does. If their water levels are high, their black-headed gulls move to here. So it's what management they go on there. So there's definitely a need for a joint up, you know, thin troll fences, monitoring, and then it's trying to drag all these other people out. Like yesterday I had the wardens from Blakely Point out, show them what we do, show them our electric fences, how, you know, how it works and what I do, and hope that they take some of that away and feed that into what they do, and up to their managers as well.
RSPB have been out a few times.
So the Norfolk Wildlife is coming out later as well, and then, other people within Natural England. We've got, people every day, rest of this week and all next week as well. Yeah.
That's good. People are interested in spreading the word.
Yeah.
What about on this island? When you first met, was there loads of rabbits on here?
Yeah, so rabbits have gone.
Could you could you make more of this suitable?
We could. We could create habitat, but there's probably no need to. And again, if you looked at the bigger picture on the whole of the coast, there is enough habitat for 100,000 pairs of sandwich terns. But we won't ever get that because there's probably a holding capacity.
Right.
But there's enough habitat created. So we can already see where the sandwich terns will be in 5 years' time, assuming the spits stay. So they'll move. So when I first started here, all the sandwich terns were here, literally on this beach here. Right. And they've moved about five or six times as the spits have grown and vegetated over.
Right.
Because of the sandy and shallow gradient nature of the seabed around the Norfolk area, our coastline is continuously changing. And there are creeks, sandbars, channels developing and disappearing all the time. So just because you've been here before doesn't necessarily mean that you have the latest information on where the safest places are to go. So it's always a good idea to check out and make sure your local knowledge is as up to date as it can be.
So as the spits vegetate over, they become unsuitable, and it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because they get lots of nutrients from all the birds, so they vegetate over really quick and then they move on to the next one. So at the moment, we've always had a spit somewhere they can move to.
But we don't have a problem creating dunes. They create themselves.
Yeah.
Just because of that nutrient input, and it gathers seeds, it sticks seeds, stick to it, and get marum growing. Once marum started, it's inevitable.
Is the island still extending westwards?
When we go out, I'll show you how it's changed.
All new habitat, new vegetation that's grown, and it's just a Chinese water there, look.
There has been a lot of discussion about dogs. Something to add really to the podcast specifically for dog owners who are desperately trying to avoid all the ground nesting birds that we're lucky enough to have around here. Keeping away from the ground nesting birds is important with the dogs, of course it is. Just be aware of the opportunity for tidal cutoff. We have had many people trying to keep near the water's edge with their dogs to try and avoid ground nesting birds who've then got themselves cut off by the tide. So being water aware and remembering about that 4 hours before Wells Bar high tide time is really important. We don't want you getting cut off by the tide and putting yourselves in danger. Just want to wrap things up by having a little summary of the main water safety messages that we've talked about during this podcast. So the first one is the risk of tidal cutoff around Scold Head Island and other places along the North Norfolk coast. So if you are going out to Scold Head Island or actually anywhere where you're on a slightly remote beach, make sure you are back on the main part of the beach, dry sand or dry land, with no more channels or creeks to cross at least 4 hours before Wells Bar high tide time. If you do happen to get yourself cut off by the tide, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard. Try to stay dry and calm. And if you have got the What Three Words app and can give a precise location, hopefully that will help get help more quickly to you. The benefit of security in numbers that Neil spoke about is the same for humans. So if you are going to any of these places,
being with other people so that if there is an issue, they can call for help on your behalf is always a good thing. The coastline is changing all the time. So even if you have been here and coming here for years, things are changing. So it's always good to get an update and make sure your local knowledge is as up to date as it can be. So thanks for listening, and I hope this has really helped and you found it interesting. Bye.